pleasure of looking at Genesis 1, which is kind of a foundational part of our Christian story. It also tends to be a part of the Christian story that's widely discussed, raises a lot of questions, and is widely debated by people, sometimes quite heatedly. And I get that because we're all interested in the origins of where we come from and what the scriptures have to say about that. But my perspective is that a lot of the debates about Genesis 1 are well-intentioned, but often miss the point of what Genesis 1 is trying to tell us. And I think, actually, the worst way to teach people about something is by introducing them to debates. So you don't begin with, here's all the arguments that people are having about this passage. Wouldn't you like to know more about that? Usually not, because it just ends up kind of acrimonious and arguing, and it's difficult to figure out what from what, particularly, as we'll see in a minute, based on some of the ways that we actually read the text that we're going to look at today. And it's a bit like, Tim Mackey talks about it, it's a bit like if you went to Paris and you went to the Louvre. And has anybody ever been to the Louvre in Paris? Yep. And you go by the Mona Lisa, and you were to stand with someone else in front of the Mona Lisa, and you had a conversation about the Mona Lisa, and you began by saying, we're not really sure if this was painted in 1503 or 1506. And there's a debate over what brush size that Da Vinci actually used. And is she smiling or is she smirking? And anyway, who is this Lisa? Was she someone that he knew? Was she just someone who came into pose? And we could have this debate, and someone might have one opinion, another person might have another opinion, and then we would kind of agree to disagree and walk away from the picture. And what have we not done? Looked at the picture. Admired the picture for what it is. Let the Mona Lisa speak to us rather than us impose all of our debate onto the Mona Lisa. I've been, actually, it's tiny. And they've got this whole thing as well about, is it the real Mona Lisa? Did they have the real one down in the basement? And they've got a fake one. Anyway, all these debates about it. And so these debates that we have about Genesis 1 are often, they're often about our concerns, but they're not necessarily about the concerns of Genesis 1. And so what we do is we often come with our questions and our debates and we impose them on the text, right? And so we're trying to get it to tell us this information that we want to know. And I want to suggest to you this morning that Genesis 1 is not always particularly interested in the questions that we have or the kinds of information that we want to get from it. And it's a bit like going to another country. Was it Iran you said you're from? So say we went to, say you took a trip to Iran, my friend here was talking earlier, so you took a trip to Iran and you got off the plane and you said, where's the Greggs around here because I need a scotch pie and I'm gasping for an iron brew. It's kind of like, you're expecting the culture of another country to bend to your ideas of what should or shouldn't be or what the food should or shouldn't be. Does that make sense? It's an incredibly arrogant thing to do that we would consider that what we want or the way that we think is actually the most important thing when we go and visit somewhere else. There are whole parts of the coast of Spain where you just have English cafes because people can't stand to go to Spain and eat Spanish food. They have to have sausage and eggs for their breakfast. It's just ridiculous. Well, maybe you like that. Sorry. But so coming to the text of Genesis 1 with all of our modern concerns, what we are doing, it's kind of a cultural arrogance. We are foregrounding what we think is important, and we're putting it over the text, and we're saying, answer us. But if we believe that the biblical text is authoritative, which we do, it's the word of God to us, then actually our position before the Bible, particularly before Genesis 1, should not be one of arrogance, but it should be one of humility. It should be one where we come to the text and we say we want to be taught and we want to read it the way that it has been written. And reading the Bible is like it's a cross-cultural enterprise. God has chosen to speak to a particular people at a particular time in a particular culture. And so when we humbly attempt to listen to the way that the Bible is communicated to them, through them, what a strange thing happens when we get into the particular nature of what they're saying. The text opens up and says something universal to all people at all times. Because guess what? Genesis 1 is not just written so you and I can figure out how old the universe is. Genesis 1 was written to all people at all times to say, to tell them something even more important than that. And so, what language is Genesis 1 written in? Anybody know? Hebrew, right? So straight away, we're dealing with something that's, that we all have our English translations, and that's great. But straight away, we're dealing with something that's written in another language. Do you want to hear a bit of it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to read it. If anybody speaks Hebrew in here, please forgive me, because this is going to be like me trying to speak Spanish, and my wife knows it's terrible. But I think I can read out a wee bit of it. So just so you can hear the cadence of what it sounds like originally, because we're so used to our English versions. So Genesis 1, it says, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz ve'ha'aretz hayata tohu vavohu ve'hoshek al pene techom ve'rua Elohim marachefet al pene hamayim vayomer Elohim yehi over vahi over vayar Elohim et ha'over kitov. Vayadel Elohim ben ha'uvir uven ha'hoshek. Vayikra Elohim la'uvir yovim ve'la'hoshek kara le'yala ve'hi erev ve'hi voker yovim echad. That's all right, wasn't it? People who speak Hebrew are like, no. But do you hear that? Do you hear the flow and the language and the poetry and the patterns that come out from reading that? And so if we approach it as this kind of like flat scientific text, that's not what we're being presented with. We're being presented with something from thousands of years ago, written in a specific language to specific people. It's written to them, but it is written for us. And so part of coming to the text means we have to suspend our questions. It's like there's a conversation going on that we're having, and it's over here, and Genesis is having a conversation over here. And it's kind of like, that's nice for you guys, but I want to have this conversation. So, is that okay? I think I've battered that point enough. We need to understand what Genesis is saying in its context so that it can actually speak to us. And so, as we begin the story of the whole Bible, that when we get the beginning part right, it leads to us understanding the rest of the scriptures. So what are the kinds of questions then are being asked by Genesis 1? Well, we know that it's dealing with what? Yes. I like to ask questions, so you can answer it. It's okay. It's all right. It's not just, I just don't like hearing the sound of my own voice for 30 minutes. So yes, it's dealing with creation. But even with that word, we hit a roadblock immediately with the word creation. Because we tend to think of creation in material terms. So when we describe something's existence, we generally describe it as material. So what does it mean for this chair to exist? How do we know it exists? You would say, well, because I can see it, sense, I can touch it, I can feel it. Okay, so we're using our senses to determine that it materially is there. But the Hebrew way of thinking, that's not the fullness of how they think about creation. It's not the material properties are not important to them, but something exists when it has functionality. So how do I know this chair exists? Because when I sit on it, it props me up and it gives me rest. So it has been created to allow somebody to sit down, and that's what it means. So function, what something does, its purpose, is what creation is about. So instantly we've got a jarring thing, because we want to think about material, how things came into being. And what the Bible wants to talk about is what their purpose is. That's the Hebrew idea of creation. You might think the same way about a computer. If you built a computer in a factory and you had all the components and you put them in the plastic casing, you would say that computer has been made. But the Hebrews might say, but hang on, it's just there. So what else do you need? Well, you need a power cable, so that you can turn it on. And then probably we need to have software loaded onto it as well so that it actually can do functions. But finally, it's not actually fully finished until there's a human being sitting in front of it, ironically on a chair, typing and using that computer. At that point, that computer is made. It's complete. It's created. Or another way to think about it is the difference between a house and a home. A house is a building, and it's constructed, but it's not really a home until you go in and you place things in the home and you arrange them in a way that makes it habitable and where you can invite other people into that. So we're a bit strange in Scotland because we do talk about come over to the house, but in most places they would say, come to my home. That's what we really want people to be in. And the difference is, one's a building, one is made, has been arranged to have purpose. So a material mindset then, that we might have, we are asking the questions how and when. When was it made? How's it made? What's the function? What's the process that got us here? That's how we think, because we think materially. But the kinds of questions that are being asked in Genesis 1 are actually questions of function and of order. So those questions might be who and why. And those are the questions that Genesis 1 is trying to answer. So let's look at the scripture to find out who is responsible for this creation and why it was made. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to read the first few verses in English. And what I'd like you to do is just imagine what's happening as I read it, okay? Just kind of set aside your questions and just try to get a mental picture as we read this. So this is Genesis 1. Starting at verse 1. And it says this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good. And he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day. And the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Okay, so if I'm guessing right, most of us, as we read that scene, will have imagined a dark, vast expanse of space. And then in the middle of that, you will have imagined something appearing like a globe or a sphere, a planet that's in space. And as you zoomed into that, what might that planet have looked like that you zoomed in? Kind of soupy. There's nothing that's really, it's kind of, doesn't really have a form yet. It's kind of soupy and something's happening within that soupiness, right? But this is an interesting thing for us. Do you know that we've only had actual pictures, photographic evidence of Earth as a globe since the late 1940s? Not that we didn't know it was a sphere before then, but in terms of people going out into space and taking photographs, we have early satellite imagery from the late 40s. And we've got a few up here. If we could put those up. This is the first television image of Earth from space. That was in 1960, right? Keep going. The first full disk image of seeing the whole globe was from space was in 1966. And finally, the first fully illuminated color image taken by a human being from space was taken in 1972. So our actual evidence, not evidence, but our actual perception, our visual of Earth as a globe is only about 60 or 70, 80 years old. It's not that long that we've had images like that. So why would we expect the Hebrew author of Genesis 1 to be thinking about a globe? Just an interesting question. Why would we expect that would be in their mind as their conception of what is around them, of the place that they are? I would say it can't be what they had in their mind. And if you dig into the Hebrew a little bit, you find this. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word for heaven is shamayim. It means not space or the universe. It means sky. And eretz, which is the word earth. When we hear earth, we think planet earth. But the Hebrew word eretz means land. So we're talking about skies and land. And it's hard for us to kind of somehow put our minds in something from thousands of years ago, but that's the imagery that's in their head. I think we've got a picture of it. So what did God create? What's down here and what's up there? And this is what Genesis 1 is talking about. And actually the word for beginning, the word is reshit, and it's not a precise word. It's not talking about a specific date and time. Our English equivalent would be something like way back then or way back when. So way back when God made what's up there and what's down here, this is what we're talking about. And we instantly go, but when was it made? And what was the process? And how did this stuff come into, and how long did it take for that process? And we get into all this argument, and Genesis 1 says, yeah, way back when. So we need to be asking different kinds of questions. Okay, verse 2. Now the earth was formless and empty. So what do we know that word earth means? Land. So the land is formless and empty. And this phrase for formless and empty in Hebrew, I'm going to make you say it because it's fun. It's tohu vavohu. You say that with me? Tohu vavohu. Doesn't that feel good? Tohu vavohu. Yeah, you guys are good at this. Okay. And what it means is, whenever you see it in the Hebrew Bible, it's usually referring to a desert. This phrase, tohu vavohu. We translate it as formless and void, which again betrays our material mindset, but actually what it means, it's a wilderness, a wasteland, a place where nothing grows and where nothing can live. So we've got this idea of a desert. Nothing grows there. You can't live there. And then we've got another phrase that comes up. The earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. What's the deep? Water, right? So we've got this image of water. Some translations do it as abyss. And this is like chaos waters, this kind of soupy chaos. So I'm going to ask you a question here. What do we have, a desert or an ocean? Which is it? Is it both? Does it matter? What is it trying to communicate to us? See, these are the kinds of questions that we want to ask that miss the point. What the author is communicating is, what is the nature of the pre-creation state before God gets involved? What can't you do in a desert, and what can't you do in an ocean?
You swim in the ocean.
Swim in the ocean. That's right. Okay. But what you can't do in either of them is live there. You can't live there. So this is an uninhabitable space that's there. And if you know about Israel at all, we've got this map. If you know about Israel, you can't really see the colors on here. It's not very good. And this is a modern map. This is not a biblical map. But Israel is like is on a green strip of land right here. And to the east, you've got kind of the northern tip of the Saudi Arabian desert. And to the west, you've got the Mediterranean Sea. So the Hebrews knew about deserts and seas, and how inhospitable they are. But they live right in this little habitable place in the middle, kind of like a garden. So in the middle, if we go back to the verse 2, we see the earth is formless and empty, darkness is over the surface of the deep, the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters, and in the middle of the dark, uninhabitable wilderness and chaos, the Spirit of God is there. And do that, ripping a lot of stuff off from Tim Mackie today, but if you hold your hand up in front of your face and say hello, hello. Do you feel that? Okay, now pull it back a wee bit, say hello again. Do you see it? You don't see it, but you feel it. In Hebrew, we have in English we have words wind and breath and spirit. In Hebrew they have one word for all three of those. It's ruach. And it means something, it's like a breath or something that's active, something that's invisible that has visible effects. So the Spirit of God, the invisible living presence of God that has visible effects, is hovering over these chaos, uninhabitable areas, and is ready to act and is ready to move. But how does God act? He speaks. Right? His breath produces words. And it's through the word of God that the earth, the world, is going to be created and formed and brought about and ordered as a space where life can flourish. So what's the first thing that God makes by speaking? Genesis 1:3, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, the darkness he called night, and there was evening and morning the first day. Okay, is light a thing? Yeah. Where do we get light from? The sun. And how does it get to us? These are real science questions. And my wife is looking worried because she knows that I'm a complete ignoramus about all things scientific. So I'm totally faking it here. But my understanding from Wikipedia is that light has physical properties. It's a thing. Whether it's, we call them photons or waves, light comes to us in a physical manner, okay? So, and we get it from the sun. So, God says, let there be light, and what does he call the light? Day. Not photons, not waves. Is day a thing, a physical thing? What is day? It's a period of time. So what God is instituting here on day one is time. He's ordering the universe in a way that you and I can navigate in it. And one of the ways that he's doing that is he creates time. He creates the day and the night. And so this is one way that God is bringing order out of chaos and bringing purpose into the world. This is how God creates, by ordering and making it a livable place with function and purpose. I want to zoom out a little bit here because we're now going to get a succession of 6 days where God is doing stuff. Actually, to be precise, the creation that God is doing is he's ordering and structuring the cosmos for purpose and for life. And now we can read this through as a strict kind of chronological day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six. And we can try to kind of argue about what layers upon what layers and what's the right order scientifically. And can you really have plants before you can have the sun and the sky? And all of these debates that go on in the thing. And again, I think those are the wrong questions. I don't think that what's, it's not a biology or a textbook that is being given to you. And the Hebrew text actually shows you this, a way of understanding it. The 6 days are actually arranged into 2 groups of 3. And I want to show you, I've got a table up here. So in the first 3 days, God is not so much going to create things, God is going to create realms. So on day one, God creates time with the day and the night. On day two, God creates a separation between the waters is what it says. It actually uses the word dome. A lot of our translations, our English translations, don't know what to do with that. So they translate it as things like space or expanse or vault. But the word is dome. That's the Hebrew conception was that there was the sky was actually a dome. And above the sky you had waters. And below you had waters. And the waters in the sky were like weather. And doors would open in the dome and let the water through. So God creates a separation between these chaos waters and creates an inhabitable space in the middle. Oh, there's a picture of it there. See that? So this is remember we're talking a little bit what would Hebrews think about when they thought about the world? They would have thought something like this. Do you know, see where the sun and the moon and the stars are? They're on the inside. Not on the outside. They don't have this idea of the universe like that. Okay, we can move on because people are frowning and this is freaking everybody out. So God creates this dome, uses this dome to separate the waters, and you've got the waters in the sky, and you've got the seas below, right? And then in the middle, you've got this vast expanse of livable space. And on day three, God creates the realm of dry land. He moves back the oceans, and the land is kind of appears out of it. And then on day three, you get a bonus creative act where God says, now let the land produce vegetation. And all of this vegetation rises up. It's interesting, though, that when God mentions the vegetation, the only trees that he mentions are fruit trees. just preloading what's going to come in a couple of weeks' time. Okay, so God creates these realms, and then on day 4, 5, and 6, he fills them. So on day 4, God puts the sun, moon, and the stars in the day and the night. How do you measure what time of day it is, other than your Casio watch? The sun and the moon, right? So you all know that in about, well, what day, what, in about 11 or 12 hours, it's going to get dark. Sure as anything, you know it's going to get dark tonight. So God is bringing order, a way that you can navigate the world. And he does that with the sun, moon, and the stars. That's what they're there for. That's their purpose, is to let you know what time it is. Then in the sky, God fills the sky with birds, and he fills the seas with fish. Okay? So now you've got the birds in the sky flying close to the waters above, and you've got the fish living in the waters below. And then on day 6, God fills the dry land, first with land animals. He speaks to the land, and animals come out of the ground. And then you've got a bonus creation on day 6 as well with humans, but we'll get to that in a second. So do you see that? So it's these two sets of 3 days, spaces that are then filled, or realms or dimensions that are then filled with living things. And this is this whole pattern of God bringing order to things. And the chapter is actually structured this way. If you look at the text, it's actually built this way. So I think we've got another thing here. It's a lot of information, this one. But I want you to see this. On each day, you've got these. Each day begins with, "And God said," and then ends with, "And there was." So on day 1, you've got this pattern. God said, and it was so. God saw that it was good, and there was. It's the exact same pattern on day 4. On day 2, you've got 3 out of the 4, one of them's missing. And on day 5, you've got 3 out of the 4, one of them's missing. On day 3, you've got all 4, and then you've got another 3 at the bottom. You've got 7 ands in total. On day 6, you've got 7 ands in total. So the author has structured it in such a way that you see these days next to each other. How many items are in here, by the way? 7. How many items are at the top? And how many items are here? What happens if you add 4 to 3? 7 is going to become important in just a minute. Okay, so it's structured this way. So we see a world that is good, but it's not perfect. It's a world that's been ordered, and it's been filled with potential. But there's still a lot of work to be done. And at the peak of God's creation, he basically appoints someone to help him rule over it. Verse 26, God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. The word that's used about the creation of humans is the word selim, this word image, and we really need to understand it. Image is a good word to use, but it can be a little bit confusing. Selim is actually the word that's used a lot through the Bible for idol. So like a representation of a god. So in ancient Near Eastern temples, they would have an idol, which they believed the presence of their god would come and meet them there in that idol. Or in other places, when they had kings, they would set up a statue of the king in places where the king couldn't be as a representation of that king. And these were symbols of presence and of authority. So when it says that we are made in God's image, it's the same word that's used for these statues that would be placed in a temple to represent the god, or the statues that would be placed out in different areas to represent the king. And in both instances, you get the same idea. The selim is a representative. The selim, or the image, is not the god or the king themselves, but it's to represent their presence and their authority. So this brings us back to this idea of function and purpose. The whole creation is ordered as a habitable space with human beings in mind. An inhabitable place is fashioned and shaped by God, and at the peak of it, the moment when it's about to become fully functional, that's when God places humans within it. And this causes God to look at the creation with humans in it, in their place as his representatives, and he declares it not just as good, but as very good. Remember that thing about sitting down in the chair? And the chair is now created and complete and made. The world, the cosmos as God has made it, is complete and made when he places humans in it. And the purpose of humans within this cosmos is to represent God, to be his image, to be his royal vice regents, to join him in ruling and reigning over the world that he has made. And I want to point out to you, if you haven't seen it yet, that the image of God is male and female. And we're going to dig into that a little bit more over the next few weeks. But just so we know that the image of the representative image of God's rule in the world is male and female. Okay. Then the final part, Genesis 2:1. The heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So when humans are placed within the world, we get a seventh day where God rests. Now, God doesn't get tired, does he? No, God's not knackered after his DIY job. He's not having to take a nap. So what do we mean by rest? What's the name given to the seventh day by the Hebrews? Sabbath. And what is the Sabbath defined by other than rest? What's the Sabbath defined by? What do we do on the Sabbath? Somebody say out loud, all I got was, what's that? We don't work, so that's the rest part. What else do we do instead of working? We worship. Day 7 is a day of worship. And so worship is centered on God's presence. So for God to rest, it means that God is sitting on his throne, allowing his presence to radiate through the whole cosmos. And it's as if God has taken up residence in his holy temple. There's one thing that day 7 doesn't include that all the other days included. Do you know what that is? It doesn't say it was evening and morning. The seventh day doesn't end. There's no end to it. That's because God's vision for creation is an ordered place full of life and potential where humanity is appointed as his representatives to rule and reign over the world as they enjoy the presence and the restfulness of the sovereign God who is there with them. That's what it means for creation to be complete. For God to create the world means to bring order and function and purpose, and the height of that creation is for humanity to rule and reign with him. But today, our culture is detached from this revelation that we've just described. So consequently, we have created our own myths of origin, myths that center around ideas of material and chaos, of randomness, of a lack of design, of us being able to be whatever we want to be. We have a cultural mythology that's different from this truth, this reality of what God has done. Our cultural mythology says that we can be whatever we want to be, that we can create ourselves. But Genesis 1 says there is an order and a purpose and a meaning, that there is rest to be found, but that rest is only found in receiving the world, the good world, as God has made it for us, and to join with him in his purposes and plans for it. And so the story of Genesis 1, and I am finishing, promise. The story of Genesis 1 is actually really important in the way that we communicate the gospel. So I've tried hard not to focus on all the debates about it because I think they take us away from the story that needs to be communicated. The story is this: the world has been ordered and made by God, it's been made good by him, and human beings have a purposeful role in it, to rule as his representative kings and to care for the earth and for each other under God's instruction and in God's presence. But as the story is going to bear out in the coming weeks, instead of accepting their place with God, humanity has decided they would rather try to become gods themselves. Consequently, humans have rejected the availability of God's presence and his word to us and have established their own rule on the earth. And the results of this rebellion are devastating. human management of the world, detached from God, has brought destruction and violence. But God's answer to this, and we see this in the way that the story ultimately ends, God's answer is not to destroy the world and to escape from it, but rather to restore his good rule, his good management over the world, so that people can once again enjoy order and purpose and God's presence. And that is why Jesus ultimately has come, to both restore God's management of the world and to redeem humanity's failed management. What is the message that Jesus came proclaiming? Do you remember? What was Jesus' gospel? The kingdom of God is near. The kingdom of God is the kingdom. God's rule and reign has returned to the earth in Jesus. And as the one who is both God and human, Jesus shows what it means for God to be present, to instruct, and to lead us. And he also shows us what it means for humans to live connected and submitted to God's rule and reign. And Jesus says that the way that we act as God's representatives is to repent of our arrogance, our rebellion, and our desire to lord it over each other, and instead to become like servants, to desire the best for others, and to share our life with one another, just like God did in the beginning. And Jesus' coronation is actually on a wooden cross, where he accepts and absorbs all of the consequences of humanity's decisions to act as gods themselves. Jesus' crucifixion reveals a devastating truth. Humans have become so intent to be their own gods, so arrogant in their belief over their own power and wisdom, that they will ultimately kill God when he appears to them in love to call them back to their original purpose. But Jesus overcomes this death through his resurrection. It's his declaration that there are no earthly powers greater than the sovereign God who creates all things, and he is enthroned as a ruler over everything. Those who give their allegiance to this king find that their lives become ordered with purpose. They learn how to live in the good world that God has made, and they enjoy his presence within them by his Spirit. And so the story is going to end not with an abandonment of the world, but by its renewal, when Jesus returns to finally establish his throne, and humanity are restored through him to their rightful position within the cosmos as God's representative rulers who care for and steward this world in the restfulness of his presence.